Welcome to Chair Chat, an online web series hosted by me, Jamie Harrison, the chairman of the South Carolina Democratic Party. Our goal in this series is to begin to look at political leaders, activists, and people involved in politics in a three-dimensional manner. We will move past the political caricatures to get to know the individual. So now, let's chat. Welcome to Chair Chats, everybody. Chair Chats is a show in which we try to paint our people involved in politics in a three-dimensional manner. And I am so proud and happy for this very special Chair Chats that we have here today, because I am joined by six chairs from six Democratic parties here in the South. And so I'm going to introduce my colleagues who are doing some amazing work in their states, and then we're just going to chat a little bit, have a little lemonade, rock a little bit, and talk about ways in which we really rebuild and retake the South for Democrats. I'm pleased to my left to introduce the chair of Tennessee Democratic Party, Mary Mancini. A little fun fact about Mary, she used to own a record store and is an all-age punk rock club. Go Mary. we also have Belinda, Biafor, and Belinda is the chair for West Virginia. Belinda started her first campaign when she was in third grade. But she told me an interesting fact, a very interesting story. Apparently, her two nieces were kicked out of Bible school recently for refusing to color an elephant. Yellow dog. She got yellow dog Democrats already. So welcome, Belinda. Welcome to South Carolina.
Thank you.
I am also joined here to my left by my good friend, my neighbor here, he's the chair of the Georgia Democratic Party.
Yes.
Yeah, go Georgia. DuBose Porter. And DuBose is a proud Eagle Scout, and his four sons are also Eagle Scouts. A little fun fact about DuBose. And then my partner in crime here, she and I, we do everything together. Karen Carter Peterson, senator from the great state of Louisiana. Karen is the chair there, and she is on the forefront of electing a new governor.
Yeah.
Karen is also an avid fisherwoman, and she loves fishing, and maybe one day we can go out and throw.
Let's go. Yeah. After the election.
After the election, right. Exactly. My neighbor to the north, from the great state of North Kakalaki, Miss Patsy Kiever. She's a widow who met her current husband on her congressional campaign. See, yeah, campaigns, you win good things on campaigns. She also plays golf, and she also plays pool as well. And she's not a fisher person, as she told me. And then, last but not least, she is my Energizer Bunny friend. She is the chairperson from the great state of Florida, which is almost like three states.
Yes,
Miss Allison Tan. You know, there are a lot of folks who claim to be advocates for children and for children's rights, and particularly children with disabilities. I have never seen one as fierce and as vociferous as Allison Tan. And so I want to thank Allison for being here and being a part of the Chair Chat.
Thank you.
So guys, a new South. That is the theme for this First in the South presidential candidates forum. But before we talk about the new South, maybe we should just revisit the old South. And it used to be a stronghold of the Democratic Party, but DuBose, what happened?
Well,
a lot. You know, the things that still that people need throughout the South would be better with Democrats than Republicans. Look at, I'm from the rural part of Georgia. And, you know, it's where the hospitals are closing because Georgia refuses to expand the Medicaid expansion. I mean, the areas that need it more than anywhere, the areas that can't attract jobs because job training and education has been cut, is in our region. You know, it's more important in the South for Democrats to take back over because Democratic priorities are better. We have got to do a better job explaining that. We thought people knew the good works we did and didn't defend them. And we let someone else define who we are.
Yeah. Amen.
And we've got to take that back, and we've got to take it back quickly to turn our area around. And I think that's in all the southeastern states here.
Let me ask you a question for all of you. How many of you in your state expanded Medicaid with the Affordable Care Act?
Not one of us.
None of us.
Not one.
Wow.
And it is shameful. We were going to be joined here by our friends from Kentucky who were able to do it. But Belinda, you did in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. How did you do it?
Wasn't easy. But we got some folks covered that were not covered before. So.
And that is something, and I know our colleague in Arkansas right now is working on some type of plan in terms of Medicaid expansion as well. Karen, and for your candidate is running for governor, has the Medicaid expansion been a part of that discussion?
It has been. It's been a significant part of the discussion because we've unfortunately had to endure 7.5 years thus far of Bobby Jindal.
Good Lord.
And he's helped. He has been the biggest promoter of our campaign because he's just abominable. Yeah. And he's about 24% in the polls right now. So we get to run. We have an election in 2 weeks and 14 days. And we've got a great candidate. We've got a flawed opponent in David Vitter, the senator. And we were also running against Bobby Jindal and what he's done to the state for the 7.5 years. And he hasn't accepted Medicaid, but it's on the agenda. In fact, in the primary, we just had the primary a couple weeks ago, every candidate, all three Republicans, have said then that they were open to expanding Medicaid. That's how critical it is because there were 240,000 people that are uncovered in what we described as the Jindal gap. And so where we are now is that we've got David Vitter and our great candidate and John Bell Edwards, who's a West Point grad and just a phenomenal guy. The race has come down to. We're going to expand Medicaid because our guy's going to win on November 21st. Promise you. So he's putting people first, and we're going to win that race. But it's come down to character.
Yeah.
And I'll say with respect to the Old South versus the New South, in that discussion, it's about voting your values. And neither Bobby Jindal nor David Vitter represent the values of the people in Louisiana nor across the South. And we've got to get back to making sure that we define ourselves, as DeBose said. We can't let others define us. It's about making sure higher education is adequately funded. Bobby Jindal took $800 million out. It's about making sure that people have access to health care. He didn't expand Medicaid. He voted against and consistently vetoed or stopped bills to help women with equal pay. Didn't want to increase the minimum wage. So we don't have to get into the social issues and the fear factor. That's how they've won.
Mm-hmm.
We got to stay on middle class economics and move the ball and not get caught up. Because when Republicans voted in the last couple of decades, according to social issues, whether it was gay marriage or whether it was being pro-choice or pro-life, right, or pro-gun or gun control, that's not what moved the ball forward for everyday families. That didn't help them to put food on their table and take care of their family members. Mm-hmm. And so that's resonating now because we've got a message that works.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let me see a show of hands. How many of you currently have a Democrat, either in the U.S. House or let's take the House off, a Democrat in the United States Senate or a statewide Democrat
U.S. Senate.
U.S. United States Senate?
Council of States.
You have a statewide council?
We don't have a U.S. Senate, no. We lost ours.
Yeah. And
we have one senator and all but one state Board of Public Works.
So it says to me, and we're in trouble here in the South. So the question is, what is our game plan in order to take the South back? Are you guys doing anything that's particularly interesting or unique in your states?
Yeah, so in Tennessee, I mean, I think we're in the same position that that you all are in too, is that the state is always described as a red state. And what I'm finding as I travel around is that it's not really as red as they want us to think it is. So for instance, as I travel around to our county parties, there'll be 25, 35 people in a room at a county party meeting, and their question always is, how do we get folks that are voting against their own economic self-interest to vote for Democrats? My comeback is, we're not even getting the people who agree with us to come out and vote. Yeah. So turnout, I think, is actually key, and turnout is the first step. So when I go to these counties, I bring a number with me, and that number is how many people voted for Barack Obama in their county in 2012. And so I'll be sitting in a room of 25 Democrats who are bemoaning the fact that there are no Democrats in their county, and 5,000 Democrats in their county voted for Barack Obama in 2012. So that means that there's 4,975 Democrats out there that county party is not reaching out to, right? And those are the people we have to reach out to first. Those are the folks that we have to get involved in the party as volunteers, helping us register folks to vote, helping us get out to vote when the time comes, or at the very least, turning them out during an election. Mm-hmm. So I think when you look at it, when you break it down on that level, what we're noticing is it looks a lot redder than it actually is. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because of the way they redistricted when the Republicans took over. So I think there's a lot of hope out there, actually. I think that it wasn't that long ago that Tennessee had a Democratic governor that won his reelection in all 95 counties.
Wow.
And that was not that long ago. So we can get back there again, and I think we all could get back there again very soon. Very hopeful.
You know, in West Virginia, it's the same way. We're painted with that red brush nationally. But if you look at our overall state races, 67% of the others are Democrats, you know, in these counties. And so what we've started doing is strengthening our county committees in this off year since we haven't had elections. And what we've done is a little bit of what Mary's talking about, but we went one step further and found those folks that voted in 12 that didn't come out in 14, and we're calling them now to find out why and what's going on and why they didn't vote.
Well, and I would say the same thing's going on in North Carolina. We used to be a very blue state, and we were always very proud of our education and our education system from kindergarten through the university, and that has been chipped away at since the Republicans have taken over. So, and I think that all the surveys show that the people are with us on the issues, mm-hmm. and we need to stick to the issues. We need to get everybody out to vote, get our base out to vote. But an interesting trend that we saw happen in Kentucky is the unaffiliated votes that we all go after. Mm-hmm. We all think that we sort of feel like they're going to go our way, but they did not go our way in Kentucky. And we need to be very careful, I think, again, to stick to the issues and the particularly the millennials, mm-hmm. because they're interested in issues much more than they are either of the parties. And so let's talk to them and educate them about the issues and then be sure they get out to vote. And I think they'll vote with us.
There's a Ellison.
An elephant in the room, and no pun intended.
Yeah.
White voters in the South. I think in this past election cycle here in South Carolina, Vincent Shaheen, who was our candidate for governor, got about 24% of the white vote, which was a drop from 2010, where he got about 29% of the white vote. DuBose, I know you had two superstar candidates in Georgia,
right.
And I think they had very similar percentages of the white vote. And Karen, you had Mary Landrieu, whose the Landrieu name is akin to the Kennedy name in Massachusetts, and what, she was 17-18%?
That's right, and 21%.
DuBose, you're an endangered species here in the South because you're a Democrat, you're white, and you're male.
Right.
How do we tackle this issue? How do we bring white voters back into the Democratic fold?
Yeah, it's got to be on issues that matter. From millennials who believe in science. So environmental issues, we need to go out there strong on who we are. on clean air and water. We have our attorney general in Georgia filing suit against the Obama's move to close the coal-fired plants. Mm-hmm. But young people believe in science. On white vote, white business people in small towns, their hospitals are going broke. They really are going broke. So these chambers of commerce that have become an arm of the Republican Party.
Yes, they are.
Should not have a lock, because you can't recruit business where you can't provide health care, where you don't have job training.
Schools.
How can a teacher vote for a Republican when they either vote Republican or don't vote at all is amazing to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think we've got to be louder on those issues that we know matter.
Yeah.
And with white voters, I guess we've got to define some things too. In my area, again, as you know, I said I'm from a rural area. When I tell some of these good old boys who love to go fishing in the river that they cannot cook those fish at home because their daughters who are pregnant cannot eat it because of the amount of mercury that's in there. You know, they used to think that is a radical idea, but as an old Boy Scout, it's just leaving the campsite better or as good as you found it.
Yeah.
That's not a radical idea. Mm-mm. It's cleaning up a mess that had been made. And we've got to relate those issues in day-to-day terms that people can understand. And I think that's all families. But I think we've got to be stronger on those things that truly make a difference in people's lives, whether it's clean air and water, whether it's their schools, whether it's transportation in Atlanta that's a mess, or health care,
yep.
Something very basic that people are not receiving in most of our states because Republicans just do not want to acknowledge or do anything to support the President of the United States, who put a great plan to give a lot of people the health care they deserve and need.
Mm-hmm. That's powerful. You know, the Republicans have, for a long time, taken this issue of values, mm-hmm. and basically use it as their mantra, their calling card. You know, they have values voters, but it seems like Democrats have some real, true, and core values. So why are we not articulating that? What's the challenge there, and how can we do a better job of relaying our values to these voters?
Well, what we've seen in the South is that everybody, all of the candidates use Kentucky, for example. Just in the last couple of weeks, people in the campaigns in the South have focused on the president, right?
Mm-hmm.
In these gubernatorial races, it's happening again. Just in the last couple of days after the Kentucky race, we've seen millions of dollars come in from the RGA, and the whole focus is the president.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people of Louisiana are very clear about what Governor Jindal did to the people of Louisiana. It has nothing to do with the president.
Mm-hmm.
And we are not getting skewed in our vision. We're very clear about voting our values, values of opportunity, values of faith, values of equity and inclusion. And that we have a party, unlike the other side, that gives the opportunity for everyone to sit at the table. For example, I have a perspective that's different from my candidate on several issues, but that's not what we're going to get caught up in,
mm-hmm.
right? And we can't let them dictate that agenda and define us, as DeBose said earlier, on what our values are, right? We've got to step out there and say, we got a big tent. There's room for pro-life and pro-choice. There's room for the debate on gun control. And there's room for the debate on gay marriage and equity issues, right? Racial justice. Put them out there, right? And say, but that's not what we're voting for when we are trying to get a governor to run government. It's about the size of government. It's about who you take care of and how the size of government, but also what happens with business. We had Bobby Jindal came in with a $1 billion surplus, and it was a Democratic governor when he came in. He's leaving with a $1.6 billion deficit. That should be easy, right? Mm-hmm. Democrats governed well, left a surplus, Republicans for 7.5 years. That's a fiscal issue. The conservative have called me one of the most fiscally conservative members of the Senate. It's because it's true. We can be responsible. We can hold government accountable. We can't just let them peg us as being you know, irresponsible. And we're certainly not for big business, right? And so the contrast has to be framed, and we've got to stay on the issues that matter to average voters.
That's powerful.
So
Mary?
Just to expound off of that just a little bit, we have left kind of a vacuum. We did in the past leave a vacuum, and we did let Republicans define who we are, right? They kind of filled the vacuum up. We also made the mistake, I think, of using their language when we talk about issues, which is also an issue, which is also a really big issue. So, you know, there's a third way. I think most voters are very pragmatic and very common sense. And so, yes, I think we need to lead with kitchen table issues. You know, obviously, things like raising the minimum wage, increasing or expanding Medicaid, equal pay for women, which, by the way, if you ever want to laugh, you should watch one of our state representatives, Susan Lynn, actually fight against equal pay for women. So that was fun. But the other issue is just how we talk about those social issues, right? Marriage equality and abortion and gun, you know, common sense gun regulations. There's a third way where we don't have to use the terms pro-life and pro-choice, right, which are very polarizing. We also have some of our Democratic members who you describe themselves as pro-life, which, you know, again, I agree, we have a big tent, but can we get them to talk about it in an issue that, in a way that resonates with most voters, which is, we all want there to be fewer abortions. You know, that's the bottom line, but how do we get there? We want to get there by talking about, you know, access to women's, you know, reproductive health care for women, right? We want to talk there about age-appropriate reproductive health education in schools. You know, they want to just, you know, they want to just say no and not even protect the life of a mother, right? So if we talk about it in those issues, I think that we can come together and make it a better conversation, and a conversation that, when you knock on the door of a voter and you talk about it that way, somebody who's on the fence, somebody who's got a lot of common sense, they're going to come over to our way. So I think also using the right language as we go about this process of defining who we are and creating our value statement is also very important.
Jamie, if I could.
Yeah.
We've studied this a lot in Florida. What we've learned is that Floridians don't trust Democrats because we have to learn first. They won't listen to us until we talk to them about money, until we talk to them about spending, until we talk to them in ways that they can learn to trust Democrats when it comes to government programs and government spending. I don't see programs, as we talked before, as entitlement. They're empowerment. They allow families, when in a duress, in a situation of duress, to reach for that safety net and then spring out of it and be empowered to move on. And until we can learn how to talk to, in the South, to our voters about what government is, smart, efficient government is, they won't listen to us on the other stuff. So we're struggling with that, and we're working on that in Florida, and that is something that is a key to us, to get them to listen to us on the other stuff that matters. And so that is, and we didn't get into this boat overnight.
No.
We're not gonna get out of it overnight, but we are doing this incrementally. I applaud what you're doing in Louisiana. I know you all just have gone through some tough elections, election by election by election, so that we, by the time 2020, with the next redistricting, we're in a much better posture. So it is incremental. I wish it could be overnight. Believe me, but I know you do too.
I would like to change the conversation just a little bit. Not the conversation we're having, but the conversation we have where the Republicans talk about government is a business. Government is not a business. Government is the delivery of services.
Correct.
That help the people that you're talking about get out of bad situations. It's the common sense for the common good, and we've lost this. We've lost the whole idea of the common good.
And government's been demonized by Fox News.
Right.
I mean, we know when the regular average voter out there thinks about government, what does it conjure? It conjures up
this government.
Right.
It's just putting money in pockets.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they call public schools government schools.
Right. And so when we advocate for access to health care and to appropriate and fair public education and for the things that are values and that we care about, for fairness and equality and healthy water and air, when that's what we're fighting against, a whole demonization of the way we help deliver those services. And so that's
the thing is, you got to call out hypocrisy when you see
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right.
And so they're there. The other side, the Republicans are on the other side, running for office, getting a government paycheck. Yeah. Right. None of them are turning down their salary when they run for whatever office it is. Yep. That's number one. And they're all promoting major contracts for big business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's in healthcare or education, they're contracts all across every level of government.
And then
and
tax
they're promoting
cuts.
It.
And then
and
tax cuts for their cronies.
Taxpayer money, sometimes in the form of a payout in a contract, or mm-hmm. it's corporate welfare.
Right.
Or it's corporate welfare. Mm-hmm. And we hear a lot about that on the local, state, and national stage. But I think you have to call it out, and that's what we're doing. You can't purport to hold certain values, and the actions don't meet the rhetoric.
Correct.
Well, one thing that's interesting right now in this discussion that came up in the last Republican presidential debate was about Marco Rubio's attendance record in the United States Senate.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if any of his Republican colleagues are going to talk about the fact that he's getting his government paycheck and not reporting to work all the time.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But we'll see.
Jamie, you know, in West Virginia, we had a Democratic legislature for 80 years. Got turned around in the last election. And you know, we sat back and watched coal mine safety go backwards. We watched 18-year-olds, they wanted to introduce legislation to allow 18-year-olds to carry a gun with no permit, concealed weapon, with no permit, no training. And, you know, our message to those Democrats has to be, you know, it's not what we can do for you anymore, it's what we can keep them from taking away from you now.
Yeah.
Because that's what they're doing. They're going back and stripping everything away that we worked
so hard to
get. Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's why it's so important that the Democrats retain the White House in 2016, because the number one objective is to all of the progress that we've made under President Barack Obama is to retreat from that,
mm-hmm.
and is to run away from that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about the perception of candidates and probably even the perception of state chairs. And most people look at state chairs and look at some of the Democratic candidates and think, oh, they're well off, you know, these are affluent people, they don't understand the problems that I have each and every day to put food on the table and what have you. But many of us, many of our candidates have gone through the same type of human experiences that impact all of the working folks. Can some of you guys give us, you know, Allison and I, we had a conversation about student loans,
mm-hmm.
and the importance of the programs and grants for student loan performance.
Right. My mom was one of eight children, and we had nothing. She had nothing growing up. My father grew up in an orphanage, and I was told, your job as a child is to grow up and go to college so that you can provide for yourself. The issue was, of course, we had no money for me to go to college on, and so my mother would actually take out 90-day loans to help cover the costs at home so that we could pay the tuition. And fortunately, I went to a state school in Florida, Florida State University, go Noles, and I had student loans. And it was through that I was able to, I'm the first one in my family, my mother was one of eight, to go to college. And I only had that opportunity because of the student loan program, and that's an opportunity that we as Democrats want for everybody. And this isn't just the I've got mine club that the Republicans espouse. We want every person to have the same opportunity, a good public school education, completely educated in public schools. And my children are in public schools right now in Florida. And if it weren't for that, I wouldn't have had the opportunity to grow up, go to work in the Florida legislature, go on to become an advocate and be where I am right now. I'm very grateful for that. And that is something that Democrats espouse. That's one of our core values.
Mm-hmm. On the next Chair Chats, how do we and what can we do in order to call out that hypocrisy? What do we need? Are there tools that we don't currently have as state parties, or is there something that we need from our national party?
I think we've got to create some more the hell you say moments.